You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running out the door.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Hope you've had a good weekend. Hope you made it to a farmer's market. I wasn't able to go to the Santa Rosa Farmer's Market yesterday, but I spent a really long time at the Sebastopol Farmer's Market today, and it was just glorious. Everything just smelled so fresh, and there were farmers there that I didn't think were going to start the market quite so soon, but Dave Legros of Bumblebee, I think it's Bumblebee Seafood, Bumblebee Fish. He was back, and he just had he had some of that fabulous flounder. He had some crawfish from New Orleans. He had some jumbo shrimp from New Orleans. And he talked, I'm going to try to have him on sometime soon. He talked about a really interesting plan. You've probably heard that salmon, we may actually have a salmon season this year. The salmon populations are looking pretty healthy. And he's thinking about starting a salmon CSA. And I just think that is such a great idea. And he wants to do it so that he lets you know when he's coming back in, you meet him at the dock and you buy the salmon right off the boat. And it doesn't get any fresher than that unless you go out yourself. Anyway, I will keep you posted about that. It was just great. A great day. Ken Orchard was there with carrots. There hadn't been any carrots there last week. Nancy Skoll had just some of her gorgeous asparagus. I've never had better asparagus than what she grows. Almost everybody had eggs. We talked about that last week when Paula Downing was on. There are now finally enough eggs at the farmer's market, so you never have to worry about running out of eggs and having to buy them in a grocery store again. And I want to tell you, speaking of farmer's markets, there's a new feature at my blog, Eat This Now, which you find at the Press Democrat website. You just go to PressDemocrat.com, click on blogs, and you'll see me. I'm the second one listed. But once a week, or twice a week until probably the middle of May, I'll be featuring one particular farmer's market. It will be called Fresh from Our Farmers, and then the name of the city after that. And it will be a regular feature, and it will also then show up in the town section. So if it's Petaluma, it'll show up in the Petaluma section. And if you have something about a farmer's market, if you have a question, if you have something you want me to be sure to check out, just, you know, leave a comment at the blog site or send me an email. We always give the email address at the end of Mouthful, but if you want to write it down now, it's catsmilk@sonic.net. So I think it's going to be a great season for farmers markets. I'm excited about all that's happening. I'm also excited about tonight's show. There is a wonderful book, and I'll just tell you a little story, because When I saw the title, An Extravagant Hunger, I immediately thought of Malcolm Gladwell and his book Blink, because he has that concept of thin slicing, where in a second you can get the big picture, and that reaction is as valid as sort of the slower, more logical way of getting to understand something. The second I read the title, An Extravagant Hunger, The Passionate Years of M.F.K. Fisher, I knew that the writer, Ann Zimmerman, had captured Mary Frances. So many writers and so many people in the food world have misunderstood her. And along comes someone from a younger generation than Mary Frances and has, I suspect, captured the essence of one of the 20th century's greatest writer. And on that note, welcome to Mouthful. Oh,
thank you. That's such kind words.
Well, the title is so perfect. It really is.
I worked long and hard on that title. I have to admit that the book was originally concepted and sold with a title that I didn't like. I've never been particularly good at titles. And it got all the way to about this time last year when my manuscript was due in about 8 weeks. And all of a sudden, I just knew in the pit of my stomach that the title I had wasn't right.
What, will you tell us what that was?
Oh, man. I can't believe I'm going to say it on the radio. There's this piece of M.F.K. Fisher writing that comes from the Gastronomical Me, and when she's just arrived in Paris for the first time in 1929, and she's 21 years old and newly married, and she's talking about Paris and how the sights and sounds are and tastes are new and amazing, and that she was young and in love and wrapped in a passionate mist. And somewhere along the line, someone got the great idea that we could sell the book with the title A Passionate Mist, which I never really liked, but I always sort of figured out I would deal with later. And then I just got very lucky to have such a great publisher, Counterpoint, who, when I came to them this time last year and said, I just really don't feel like that title is right for the book at all. It's not evocative enough. It's not interesting enough. And it doesn't, as you said, really capture her.
No, it doesn't really tell you anything about
it
her.
Doesn't tell you anything. And so they were cool, but they volleyed the ball right back to me and said, okay, tell us what you want the title to be. So I spent probably, it felt like a long time. It was ultimately probably only a week just carrying this notebook with me everywhere and writing down senses and words and colors and trying to think of what I really wanted the title to be. And then I kind of just had this light bulb moment that extravagant mm-hmm. hunger just was it.
Well, so. It's perfect. And it's perfect for several reasons. And one of them that I think immediately that allowed me, say, to thin slice mm-hmm. the book is so many people mistakenly call her a food writer. And it happened to her whole life. And people would say it to her, and she'd say, I don't think of myself as a food writer. And what I've always said is she writes about hunger. She
right.
doesn't write about food. She writes about hunger. So you go just straight to the heart of her writing. So right. I just think it's, you know, a light bulb
Thank
experience
you.
Is what it should be.
Well, it's funny because that you mentioned, you know, her ambivalence about the title of food writer, because you're 100% right, as you know. But it was so interesting because I didn't realize until fairly far into the book the task I had set myself up for. Uh-huh. Because, you know, she's a food philosopher. She's a life philosopher. You know, she doesn't, mm-hmm. To call her a food writer is completely... completely inaccurate, though I understand why people put that label on her. It's really so, so, so much more, and that's what I've tried to capture in the book is just her hungers and how those hungers were fed through her life and how that led to her creative, you know, blossoming. So,
what was it that initially drew you to Mary Frances?
That's an interesting story. I went to college in McMinnville, Oregon, which is not unlike, you know, going to college in the wine country of mm-hmm. California.
Yeah, so it's Pinot Noir country.
Pinot
there.
Noir country, yes. And so I had heard her name in my life there. But then I went to graduate school in San Diego, and I almost immediately disliked it. I just didn't graduate school didn't jive with me. The culture of Southern California didn't jive with me. But I was going to class and doing my thing. And one day I was in the library gathering books to do a paper on Zelda Fitzgerald, or so mm-hmm. I thought. And I was standing in the library and I saw the rows and rows and rows of books about the Fitzgeralds and knew that in order to write a graduate school paper, I was going to have to read all of them and then develop my own new theory and then write the paper and that was going to take a long time. And Fisher is very close to Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And there was this very small Fisher section, maybe only a dozen books. But I recognized the name, and I pulled out a book that had beautiful black and white photos of M.F.K. Fisher, you know, in France and in Italy and on the deck of a home, just sort of luxuriously leaning back after a good meal. And initially, that was what sparked me. I just kind of wanted to know more about this woman that was in the photographs. But what happened next is kind of interesting. I checked out a handful of MFK Fisher books and took them back to my little apartment in San Diego. And that weekend, a huge fire erupted in Southern California. And
oh, that really bad one.
One of the really bad ones, exactly. And I became trapped, not in an unsafe way, but just the air quality was really poor and they kept shutting school day after day after day. And I was basically alone in my tiny little apartment for an entire week with a couple of bags of groceries and my MFK Fisher books. And by the time I came out, I was just, you know, completely in love with her as a subject and as a kind of character at that point, and in love with her work. And it just really, it kind of changed my life. So
that's a great story.
It's kind of phoenix out of the ashes. You know, I was in this really bad point. And, you know, really what happened was that reading her work just really told me how important it was to take some time out for myself. And I wasn't feeling very happy and I wasn't feeling very good about myself. But that she taught me that if I didn't nourish myself, nobody else was going to. So I kind of changed my whole philosophy of living and eating. And I would spend all, you know, all this time on Sunday afternoons cooking these big meals that then I would take in Tupperwares to my graduate school classes. And all the other students thought I was nuts. They couldn't figure out why I wasn't eating takeout and how I found the time to do this. But I just, I realized that if I didn't invest in myself in that small little way, no one was going to. And it was just this very simple, but very profound thing that could bring me both a lot of pleasure and just improve my life all the way around. So
she would be thrilled with that story.
Thank you.
She would be thrilled. She would be thrilled with that story.
It's always fun to talk to people who actually met her, because of course I didn't. I am, you know, people always, every once in a while, get emails and people will say, did you know her? And I have to kind of embarrassingly admit that I think she died in 1992, so I was, you know, a 14-year-old or something like that. So it's always very meaningful when people who know compliment me like that.
And it's, you know, it's not, I don't think you should be embarrassed about that. You know, people write, I mean, people reach so far back into history to write about people, and your lives actually overlapped.
Right.
And there's a little bit of magic about that, I think.
Right. And I just have always felt like that I saw a story that maybe other people didn't. You know, MFK Fisher wrote so much about her own life. I mean, most of her work is autobiographical, but I still, my inside voice kind of from the very beginning told me that there was a deeper story that wasn't being told. And I've always sort of felt compelled, you know, to dig through that and tell it. So,
what can you tell us about that?
Well, I think the big thing was that, you know, she wrote all of this beautiful work. But I always felt like it was just really tinged with sadness. And I never quite understood what the sadness was, you know, when we're talking when I was an innocent neophyte reader, where I had not read very much MFK Fisher. And then, you know, perhaps I read The Gastronomical Me, and you know that she had Al Fisher as a husband, and then you know that she had Tim Parrish as a husband, but you never know what happened, how she, you know, got from one man to the other. And then you know that Tim died, but you never know what happened. Yeah. And I just always, I wanted to know more, and I wasn't, to be totally frank, I wasn't always satisfied with the answers I got. I wanted to know from her what happened. Uh-huh. And that really was what inspired me to go to the Schlesinger Library on the Radcliffe campus and read her actual papers and work with her letters to see if I could find out from her what the real story was.
How did reading those letters compare to filling in those gaps to, say, reading Last House, which was a posthumous collection, which I thought was extremely haunting, and it filled in some of the gaps.
I think the biggest thing was, and what I was so amazed by was, you know, she wrote so much throughout her entire life, but, you know, that first year, 1929, when she went to France with Al Fisher, she wrote sometimes 5 and 6 letters a day, multiple pages long. Yeah. And so she really, to hear kind of how she felt in the moment as it was all happening is different than hearing a reflection of what happened. So, but what's interesting about MFK Fisher is that she, I think, was very, I mean, you could tell me, but she was very smart and very sly. And so it really did take a lot of research from all different points of her life to kind of get these little details that you could, you know, weave together into the right story. Because there were certainly pieces from, I think it's in Last House, where she writes about this meal that she had on the train from, going into Paris on their on her very first day in France, and how that was the most important meal she ever mm-hmm. ate. And she gives all of these very vivid details that, that had not been in any of the letters yeah. that she wrote. So she was she had a seemingly good memory, and her time in France, I think, you know, was very important to her. So she it was alive in her mind.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about what was happening between her and Al Fischer during that time that she doesn't really tell until
right.
much, much later?
Well, that is another fascinating story. You know, she was pretty mum. Admittedly, she was pretty mum even in her letters about what was going on mm-hmm. between the two of them. But that silence, in a way, was what gave me the clue that that maybe not everything was as perfect as it seems. Mm-hmm. Because she wouldn't write very much about him in any of the letters, and then she would just kind of dash off two lines, like, Al's great, everything's wonderful, we're so much in love. And, you know, at one point I thought, who writes like that? Who yeah. writes, you know, we're so much in love, unless you're trying to convince yourself and somebody else of the fact that you're so much mm-hmm. in love. So I kind of pieced a lot of things together from the silences, but then the kind of linchpin of my understanding of the fact that her marriage with Al was not happy, aside from things that she wrote later in her life, mm-hmm. was going to UCLA. And at the UCLA library are the papers of Lawrence Clark Powell, mm-hmm. who was a friend of both Al Fischer and MFK Fischer. And there, both there and in the Smith College collection that belonged to Al Fischer are some letters from friends of theirs that just speak pretty frankly about the fact that they never acted like a couple in love. They seemed, Al seemed disinterested in Mary Frances, and Mary mm-hmm. Frances seemed like she was kind of trying to please him, but was and successful in doing that, and kind of the most damning was this revelation that they had a nearly non-existent sexual life together.
Right.
So that, and I that had not really been, I think in other portrayals of MFK Fisher's life in France, it's been very romantic. Like, oh, here's this young mm-hmm. couple, they go to France, they're in love, you know, she starts writing about food, and it's just, you know, big romance. Yeah. And that's not what happened. And I think it's inaccurate to yeah, tell people that that's what happened.
Now, my understanding, I think you have done a lot more research about this and know much more about it than I do. So perhaps I'm hoping maybe you have some of the pieces that are missing for me.
Sure.
It seemed to me that she was in love when they started out. I don't know why he married her. She seemed to be in love with him, and he seemed to be sexually put off by her. That's been what I felt, and I thought that right there has to have just shattered her heart.
No, you're very astute. I think that's a very good summary of what happened, and I've thought a lot about this because there's so many different elements to their story. You know, one is the fact that they even got married to begin with. But then the next one would be that they got married and left and went to a different country. And yeah. it would seem maybe that you would be inclined to stick close to home if you were marrying someone you didn't know very well mm-hmm. and that type of thing. But the nearest that I've been able to piece together is I think she was in love with him, but perhaps in love with him in the way that we are all in love with our very first love. You mm-hmm. know, it's just like the biggest and best, most amazing thing that's ever happened, but it's not based in any sort of reality yeah. or any sort of experience mm-hmm. about what that means. And I think that was probably her driving force. For him, I think that he, you know, Al Fischer is such an interesting, you know, person in this book. And he admittedly was somebody that was not the most interesting person when I started the book, and now has become very fascinating mm-hmm. to me. And part of the reason is for this odd sort of personality that he seems to have, where I think he sort of wanted to own Mary Frances. You know, he wanted to possess her. He didn't want somebody else to have her. Uh-huh. He wanted to have her. But when it came right down to it, to being a husband, to being a lover, to being a partner, you're right. He didn't want anything
interested.
To do with her. And he was beyond that. I mean, you know, not interested and not interested in trying either.
Yeah.
You know, like no sort of kind of thought process that said, well, I married this woman and, you know, we mm-hmm. went, we stood in front of our parents and we got married and then we took this big trip and now we're supposed to be living together as husband and wife. I should figure this out. There was none of that.
Yeah. And, you know, you could make a lot of assumptions about that, but he then goes on to marry someone else.
He married, you know, Alice, like you said, he's so fascinating. He married, I think, two or three more times. One of the things, oh, I wish I could remember the title of the book. And his second wife was a student of his from Smith. And after they divorced, she wrote this Romana Clef novel about a professor at Smith who sleeps with most of his students and then turns up dead one day. And it's, I ordered this copy. I wish I could remember the title. And it comes to me and it's just the typical dime store novel kind of size. But it has a fireplace poker, you know, kind of tool that's, you know, covered in blood. And that's the cover, is this gruesome sort of professor that's been murdered by one of his female students. And let's just put it this way. He didn't have none of his earlier problems, sexual problems, were evident in his later life. He was quite the philanderer.
That's so interesting. We're going to take a little musical break and come back with more talk about M.F.K. Fisher and the wonderful book, An Extravagant Hunger.
Je cherche un homme, un Pierre, Paul, un Jacques, autant. Peu m'importe comment il se nomme, s'il est un homme, je n'exige pas un Apollon qui s'a brillé dans les salons, ni un type fort comme Samson. Pour vous que j'ai un mate en bon, il n'a pas besoin d'être un milliardaire, qu'il soit beau, non, ça m'est égal. Il n'a pas besoin d'être grand lumière, star du cinéma, ni prince royal. Un homme qu'il s'appelle Pierre au Paul Autumn, pour qu'il donne son maximum. Je cherche un homme. Some movie star, a Texas oil man, or a French marquis. Doesn't have to be handsome as a picture. An ordinary guy is all right with me. Je cherche un homme qui s'appelle Pierre au Paul Autumn. Pour qu'il donne son maximum, je cherche un homme.
The book we're talking about this evening here on Mouthful is An Extravagant Hunger, The Passionate Years of M.F.K. Fisher by Ann Zimmerman. It's a beautiful cover.
I'm going to talk about the cover. Can I tell you about the cover?
Yes, tell me about the cover.
Because it is so beautiful.
And I think I know what it refers to.
So the cover is, for those of you that can't see it, you should go look it up. It's a gorgeous cover of Tangerines, which is an homage to an essay in Serve It Forth called Borderlands, in which M.F.K. Fisher writes about broiling little sections of tangerine on the radiator in Strasbourg, where she's living with Al Fisher. And it's just really one of the most sensual, beautiful. I mean, there's so much M.F.K. Fisher work, but this is one of the very first pieces I ever read. And I still think it is just, you know, probably my all-time favorite. But what's really amazing is that the artwork for this book was done by a woman named Laura Parker, who lives in San Francisco. And she was just an amazing artist to work with. And she painted from real tangerines about this time last year and did several different versions of the cover for me to pick. And all of the writing on the back of the book is MFK Fisher prose.
Oh, fabulous.
And so she's just a great artist. And if you're in the area, all of her work is displayed at Enceladas in San Anselmo.
She does these huge, large-scale
kind of portraits of fruits and vegetables. So it's just one of my favorite parts of the book.
And I just, since you mentioned it, I just have to read this. It was then that I discovered how to eat little dried sections of tangerine. My pleasure in them is subtle and voluptuous and quite inexplicable. I can only write how they are prepared. In the morning, in the soft, sultry chamber, sit in the window peeling tangerines, three or four. Peel them gently. Do not bruise them as you watch soldiers pour past and past the corner and over the canal towards the watched Rhine. Separate each plump, little pregnant crescent. If you find the kiss, the secret section, save it for Al.
It's just like, so beautiful. Yeah. You know, regardless of her relationship with Al and how that turned out, I think that, you know, that's a beautiful passage.
It is. And, you know, if she had been really happy with Al, we might not have her beautiful work, because one of the things that, for me anyway, has always made her work so compelling is that longing that's inherent in it. And, you know, I do the same thing with tangerines after reading it. I don't have a radiator. I just put them on a dry pan in the oven, in a really low oven, until their skins crackle. Yeah. And they're so good.
I've never done that, but I was in New York last week for a book reading or two, and I had a broiled half of a grapefruit, and it was just divine. But you're so right. I mean, I think that one of the big things that I learned from looking at all of the letters at the library was the idea, you know, that, you know, she was 21 years old in 1929 when she went to France, and she couldn't work both because she was an American and because she was a woman. And she attended some art classes, but Al went off to school all day, or he was at the library, and she really had nothing to do. She had no house to take care of. They lived in a boarding house where all the meals were provided. And so she was lucky enough to just be able to sort of roam the streets, and she would go sit in coffee houses, or she would go to museums, but she would also go to farmers markets and go look in the patisseries and the tea houses. And then she would come home and she would write these long letters describing every single thing that she tasted to her family. And I think that that was her writer's practice. You know, she didn't realize that it was at the time, but I think she was also occasionally trying to write fiction or trying to write other pieces of prose. But I think that those letters were really that longing for family and kind of longing for a connection with Al while describing all of the stuff that she was seeing around her. That was how she got her start.
Mm-hmm. So what happened next? So we have this really sad relationship between her and Al. Basically, no, it was not a sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. And here's this beautiful, voluptuous, very sensual woman.
Yeah. What happened?
What happened?
So, Al and Mary Frances lived in France for 3 years. And when they came back to California, it was the midst of the Great Depression. And he couldn't find a job. Again, she still could not work. They were living with her parents, or if they weren't directly with her parents, living in a little shack in Laguna Beach that her parents owned. So I think it was a pretty debilitating time for both of them. You know, Al couldn't provide for her. She, you know, couldn't help and saw him sort of drifting farther and farther and farther away. And then what happened is that she fell in love with a neighbor. And his name was Tim Parrish. He was also married. And they started first as friends. The couples were friends. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of lore surrounding exactly what happened next. But they became lovers. And she then continued to write these pieces about food to show to him. He was a great appreciator of food. He knew how to cook, and he loved food sort of at the same level that she did, as this pleasurable sensual experience. And they ended up, what happened next is fascinating. The two of them actually ran off to Europe with his mother, which sounds odd, but it was under the guise that Mary Frances would be Mrs. Parrish's traveling companion abroad.
Was I correct? And I got this impression that somehow Al Fisher pushed her to do that.
Well, I think he certainly, you know, he pushed her by lack of involvement. Mm-hmm. But I never found anything that showed that he overtly condoned it. That being said, he certainly made it easy for her to do. He never, one of the most poignant lines that I found that MFK Fisher wrote was something along the lines that I asked my husband if I should go to Europe with Tim Parrish, and he told me yes. And you could mm-hmm. just tell that at some level she didn't want him to say yes. She wanted him to stand up for her and for their relationship and to say, no, I don't want you to go. I want you to stay here with me. But he told her to go.
I might have made those assumptions then with that.
Well, and I mean, I think that it's such a complicated, weird, ultimately, triangle. Because so what happens is she goes abroad with Tim, and yet she's writing these letters back to Al, and Al all of a sudden becomes very needy. I mean, it's interesting because we just talked about how he had no interest in her and no interest mm-hmm. in fostering this relationship. Well, no interest until he thought he was going to lose her. And then all of a sudden, that kind of early fire, whatever that was that it initially compelled him to sort of desire to possess MFK Fisher, came back. And he writes these, I mean, so sob story letters, so full of kind of like florid romantic prose that it was hard for me to pick out which, you know, snippets to use in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I love you, my darling. I miss you, my darling. I can't live without you. I've been waiting all day to read your letter, kind of prose. And she doesn't ever tell him that she's taken, you know, that she's really started this affair with Tim. So they come back to the United States. MFK Fisher moves back in with her husband, kind of resumes her marriage, and Tim goes to the East Coast to visit his family for a while, and then he sends a letter that invites the two of them, Tim and or Al and Mary Frances, to come and live in Switzerland. And I think MFK Fisher says, to my shock and dismay, Al decided he wanted to go. Okay. So the two of them go to live with Tim in Switzerland, and to use another MFK Fisher line, unsurprisingly, it didn't work. And Al ended up leaving.
Now, where at that point, mm-hmm. where is Tim's wife?
Tim's wife, he married a dramatically younger woman. I think he was, you know, 30 in his early 30s, and she was in her teens. And she became a Samuel Goldwyn girl. She was a starlet. She had, you know, designs on the big screen. And so she had actually seemingly convincingly gone away on tour and was away on tour when
they all went to Switzerland.
Well, when the original affair started. And then when she came back and found out that her husband had taken up with this friend of hers, she kind of brushed it off and said, it's okay because I had an affair too. You know, so she went off with, I think his name was John Weld. Her name was Gigi Parrish.
That's right.
So Gigi ended up marrying John Weld. And I think they stayed married for a long time. Mm-hmm. And Tim went to Switzerland. And then Mary Frances and Al followed. And they lived there together for about 2 months. And then Al took off and apparently traveled Europe mm-hmm. for a month or two. And then went to Smith, which is where he was a professor and basically until he died.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Mary Frances and Tim stayed on. They had this, I went to see it. It's a beautiful, astonishingly beautiful plot of land.
Oh, you went to see it?
I did.
Oh, gosh,
I did. It was
so
one
lucky.
Of my best, the best parts of my book research was using MFK Fisher prose to kind of weave my way through Switzerland and find what I think, you know, is in fact the plot of land. And it's overlooking Lake Geneva. Beautiful terraced vineyard property, and they lived there, you know, very happily until mm-hmm. he got sick. Which
how
was,
many years was that they lived there?
They ultimately were not there very long. Yeah. I think they were there about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'd been there just about a year when Tim got this, had this amazingly problematic blood clot in his leg that mm-hmm. resulted in his leg being amputated mm-hmm. and started them on a whole different trajectory of doctor's visits and pain and illness and suffering.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to take another little musical interlude here on Mouthful. We'll be right back.
Some may reach for the stars, others will end behind bars. What the future has in store, no one ever knows before. Yet we're
success, that elusive ray of light that will lead to happiness. Tomorrow is my turn, no more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn when my luck is returning. All these years I've been learning to save fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn, no more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving. Make life worth a living, now it's my life I'm living. And my only concern for tomorrow is my turn. Summer is gone, there's another to come. You can't stop years drifting by, even if you want to try. Though time may help you forget all that has happened before, but honey, it's too late to regret. What is gone will be no more. Tomorrow is my turn, no more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn when my luck is returning. All these years I've been learning to save fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving, to make life worth the living. Now it's my life I'm living, and my only concern tomorrow is my turn. Tomorrow is my turn.
It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Anna Jordan live in the studio with author Ann Zimmerman, who has written a lovely book, An Extravagant Hunger, The Passionate Years of MFK Fisher. Tell me about the subtitle.
Well, you know, it is not a quote-unquote typical biography, which would start with MFK Fisher's birth and end with her death in 1992. I was really compelled to write about what I felt were her most passionate years. And all of MFK Fisher's work is great, but I often feel like the work that people go back to again and again and again is that early work. Serve It Forth, Consider the Oyster, How to Cook a Wolf, Gastronomical Me, the books that were bound into The Art of Eating with an Alphabet for Gourmets. And those works were written astonishingly quite quickly, in the space of about 5 or 7 years, when she was in her 30s. And that I felt was her most passionate time. It was a time filled with a lot of despair and a lot of sadness. You know, Tim Parrish ended up committing suicide. Her brother committed suicide. But it was when that longing that you were talking about and that desire seems to show through most clearly on the page, at least for me. So I really wanted to kind of explore the life behind that work that kind of gave her her early voice, that propelled her to being this legend of food and of writing in America. And so it's the passionate years.
And it's interesting because I completely agree with you. I think you've absolutely nailed it. And for me, even though I love all of those books, for me, the height of her power comes down to actually a single chapter.
Oh, wow.
In the Gastronomical Me, The Flaw.
Yeah,
I can even barely say the chapter without choking. I say the name of the chapter, and I've read it out loud at various events, and I always get choked up. It's so beautifully written and so full of both love and pain and longing and foreboding and the sense of impending doom, that as if what's happening with her and Tim is also mirrored by the fascism spreading throughout Europe. And then to learn that she dictated that book. She dictated that book.
And she wrote it while pregnant, quite pregnant, you know, sort of on this deadline to give birth is, you know, astonishing.
Yeah, it was amazing to me. And that book is always amazing to me, the way it holds up. And people, you know, there are a couple of dirty little secrets about in the food world. One of them is, and I guess this isn't such a secret, everyone wants to be blessed by being compared to her.
Right, of course.
Everyone does.
Of course.
And then so often people will confess very quietly, you know, I've never actually read MFK Fisher. That's one confession. And the other confession is sort of this uppity. Well, you know, she actually didn't know very much about food, did she? And it's like both missing, you know, everyone's sort of missing it.
Well, and people ask me, one question that I've been getting quite often was, did she like to cook? And, you know, I never met her, but my hunch is that she really liked to eat and that she did cook and she was a very capable cook, but, you know, she wasn't Julia Child. She wasn't writing these, you know, manuals dissecting recipes. Exactly, yeah. And, you know, that's a whole different gig. And I believe that she loved to eat and that she was this sensual, passionate person. And I think that it's really interesting in food culture today that, you know, once again, we're expected to do it all, you know, that you would need to be both an eater and a cook. Like, I think it's okay to be an eater. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there's a lot of pleasure had from food. And, as someone that cooks a lot, I know that, right or wrong, sometimes I get the most pleasure from the meals I do not make myself, because the meals that I make myself, I know all the different components and I know what went into it and I know the time. And sometimes by the time I sit down, I just think, okay, now you eat. But there is something about sitting and just being able to take the pleasure and the mindfulness of mm-hmm. just eating. And that's, I think, what she did best. I think that's a gift.
I think so too. And I know when I cook, I used to cook professionally. I don't anymore. Very rarely, but when I do, the sensual part of it is the cooking.
Yes.
It's not the enjoying of the meal.
Right. No, that's a very good point. That's interesting.
And if I have people over for dinner or something, I cook in a much different way, and I try to cook in such a way that we're at the table and we spend hours around the table, mm-hmm. and it's the enjoying of it. But it's two such different things. Mm-hmm. And anyway, back to those first five books, and that's when you wanted
the
to write about her.
Yes,
the passionate years. I'm wondering... I had a very precise question. Let's see if I can... Oh, I know what I was going to say was interesting. She was well-known, but not hugely
right.
well-known
mm-hmm.
until... not among friends. As They Were came out, when she was living in Glen Ellen when mm-hmm. she wrote that. That's what brought people to her door. And if I did my math right, I think she was like 73 by then.
Well, so it's interesting. So what I think happened, you know, she wrote those five books, mm-hmm. and then had a child in 1943, and then had another child in fairly quick succession. And all of a sudden, her world was totally different. She was a mother, and not just a mother, but often a single mother. And she was also caring for both of her parents mm-hmm. in the final stages of their life. And it was the 50s. You know, food was different. It was this post-war world. And I think that she was just really bogged down with the responsibilities of working motherhood. She was still writing, but if I showed you some of those articles from House Beautiful, you would not think that they were MFK Fisher pieces. You know,
I went and found so many of those. You wouldn't. She was writing for money,
and there's no shame there. But I think it wasn't until some of those responsibilities lifted a little bit, and she did, you know, move up to here to wine country, and it was at the same time that Americans started really starting to go abroad and have similar experiences to the mm-hmm. ones that she had, and food and wine was coming alive in Northern California, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, here we have this person that has this beautiful voice and all this experience. And then I wasn't there, but my feeling is exactly what you said. She was essentially just rediscovered and then flocked to.
Right.
In droves.
Just like this huge path to mm-hmm. her door.
And then, you know, she had been writing the entire time, but I think she had a lot of ambivalence about quote-unquote food writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think she wanted to be a novelist probably at her heart of hearts, or at least writing short stories and fiction. But I think she also realized that writing about food, she was good at it.
She was very good, I thought, at writing about the moment, exactly what was going on, and observing the moment, whether that moment was eating. Joey, we have another guest in the studio, and he's disagreeing with us. I think of some of her books about the south of France,
uh-huh.
A map of another town, and then what was the title of the one about Provence?
There were just two kitchens in Provence.
Two kitchens in Provence. And there's one, anyway, and that's where I discovered her. I discovered her completely separate from anything to do with food.
Interesting.
I was in Southern California, like mm-hmm. you were, and I had was spending the night with a friend and her mother and my two little girls. Mm-hmm. And I woke up very, very early on January 1st, and I didn't want to wake anyone up, so right. I went to the bookshelf. And I, at that point, my girls were very young, and I really wanted to go to Provence. Mm-hmm. Wanted to take them and go to college in Aix-en-Provence. And I, there must have been Provence in the title, but mm-hmm. I pulled this book off the shelf, and here was this first-person narrative about a woman
living with
two little girls in Provence. And I just gobbled it up, but I didn't even note the name of the author.
Right.
Because like 2 hours later, we were in the car going to Disneyland.
Right.
And I sort of forgot about it, and then much later discovered her. But yeah, that single motherhood, and she, you know, it'd be interesting to see your take. I know you stopped at 1943, but I think there's territory to explore.
Definitely, beyond. I mean, but in a way, it would be territory for a whole different book and a whole different
sure.
exploration, because I do think that she, you know, there is still an element of just sort of passion and fantasy involved in my book. There's a lot of pain, but you know, it is this sort of like amazing story of this person that was so aware of their tastes and so aware of their pleasures that goes to France and learns more about food and wine there and falls in and out of love. And you know, it's sort of every woman's fantasy at some level to be able to kind of explore the world in this fashion. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what happens next is a different fantasy of like, how do you be a wife and how do you be a daughter and how do you be a parent and a working parent and a working mm-hmm. writer? And I agree with you completely that those years are ripe for exploration, but I didn't feel like, you know, they were right to be bundled into this
book. I think you ended
like it was a different chapter.
Oh, I agree with you completely. I love that you focused on that time period. You know, I think it does change when she has her first child.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything changes
changes.
But her writing in particular, that bundle of writing, those first books are all of a piece.
Yes.
They're all of a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then her voice, she doesn't lose her voice,
it
but
changes.
The voice,
it
changes and it takes on certain other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of her writing is beautiful after that, and it's very tinged with sadness, but sadness of a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm curious about, and
yes.
this is time's going so fast, how much exploration did you do about her mother and father, two huge figures in her life?
Sure. You know, it is so funny because I what happens in France and what happens with these lovers that she has is so exciting that occasionally her family gets a little underplayed. And it's true. They were the initial influence. She had this fascinating family. Her father, Rex Kennedy, was the owner and publisher of the Whittier News in Southern California. And her mother, Edith, was his wife. Her, you know, she was upper crust. She was came from a wealthy family, very well bred, very well traveled, and well read for that time. And what was interesting was that Edith's mother, Grandmother Holbrook, lived with the family for much of MFK Fisher's childhood. And Grandmother Holbrook belonged to a religious school of thought that believed that food, if you ate spicy, interesting food, it could compel people, especially young children, to act out in dangerous ways. And so on the Kennedy dinner table, when Grandmother Holbrook was around, which she lived with them was most of the time, was very bland, very under-seasoned foods. And then Grandmother Holbrook would go away and Edith would pull out the cake pans and bake cakes and roast big cuts of meat, and Rex would pull out a wine bottle, and there would be kind of like this bacchanal when Grandmother Holbrook was gone. And so the influence of those three people and this additional woman, Aunt Gwen, who sort of took care of the
Aunt
children.
Gwen.
And she was very important. But, you know, this kind of triumvirate of power, this, you know, father, mother, and mother-in-law kind mm-hmm. of vying for, you know, attention and who was going to be in control of the dinner table was an extraordinarily influential force. Really bouncing back and forth. I think if there was one thing that made MFK Fisher aware of her desires and of her hungers early and sort of primed her for the rest of her experiences, it was that, you know, she saw mm-hmm. this mother that was ambivalent about the kitchen and hired cooks to come in and take care of her family. And she saw a grandmother that only wanted to eat bland foods and parents that then would go out to dinner and come back and explain in great detail everything that they had eaten. And it just allowed her to hone in so soon, so young, on this human desire, this human hunger.
Yeah. Now that you've finished the book, how do you feel? I mean, how did going this deeply into someone's life, particularly such a passionate period in someone's mm-hmm. life, and sad, how do you feel on the other side of it?
I'm having a great time. I'm having so much fun talking about the book. I wasn't mm-hmm. sure I was going to like this part because it feels kind of exposing for me too, uh-huh. to do all of this. But I'm having a great time, and I think it's been really interesting. You know, I got so busy, probably really for the last year, revising the book. You know, took a huge amount of energy, and I was definitely starting to eat all of my meals in front of the computer and get really bogged down in my writing process. And I think the most interesting part about talking about her and her influence on me has been reminding myself of what I said, you know, kind of when we started, that the eating is something you do for yourself, and it should be mm-hmm. something that you step away from the computer and the phone and, you know, whatever it is you're working on, and you sit down and you have something nice and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And that's really, in this kind of more frenetic time, I'm traveling a lot and in front of people a lot, I'm trying to remember that's
yeah, to
take care of myself and to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So she's, you know, she's so applicable. Her words are so applicable to the modern eater. I really believe that. And I hope that the book will inspire people to not only want to know more about her, but to go back to her writing and sort of remember that she is this voice in American prose that I think in food culture today has a lot of wisdom.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I hope that that's what happened. I hope people will go out and pick up Serve It Forth. Or right these days, there's a lot of wisdom in how to cook a wolf.
Absolutely.
So much.
Absolutely, which she wrote during World War II. Sure. Yeah.
And then, you know, to really experience her in the full range of her power, the gastronomical me.
Yeah.
It's just exquisite.
I always tell people, or what I've been telling people recently is to get, you know, to get a copy of The Art of Eating. And, you know, yeah. when you're cooking some night and you have that 4 minutes while you're waiting for the egg to boil or whatever, you can open it up to any page and you're going to find something in The Art of Eating that will speak to you. So it's a great dip out kind of book.
Yeah, that's great advice. What do you think is next for you once you finish your book tour?
That's a great question. I think I'm poking around looking for another project. So
yeah.
Anybody has any ideas, let me know. You know, I maybe more MFK Fisher. I'm working right now on kind of compiling some essays that she wrote into new. One is a book about her writings on wine. Mm-hmm. That's still a ways off from being published. And then another that's coming out from Counterpoint fairly soon is just a lesser known, kind of less quote unquote popular MFK Fisher pieces that we're putting back out into the world.
Oh, good.
So
that's really, that's.
Yeah, and that's called Love in a Dish.
Love in a Dish?
Yep.
Oh, it's a great title. Yep, who's your editor there at Counterpoint?
I was working with a man named Bob Ickes and Jack uh-huh. Shoemaker, too,
okay.
who's, you know, the man, the myth, the legend.
Uh-huh. do you have any book signings coming up in the Bay Area, any appearances?
I do. I was thinking I should mention those, especially for readers in wine country. On April 21st, I will be at Copperfields in Napa. And on June 3rd, I will be at the Book Passage in Corte Madera.
Oh, great.
And
what day, June?
June 3rd, Friday, June 3rd. In between now and then, I'm going to Portland and Seattle, if you know anyone in Portland and Seattle. And I have, this coming Thursday, the 14th of April, I'll be at Mrs. Dalloway's in the East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a website written by AZ.com, and it lists all my readings and kind of tracks what I'm up to. I'm trying to put photos and...
So the website is written by AZ.com.
Yep. Written by AZ.com.
And I know that there's an event coming up at the Bouverie Preserve.
Yes.
Are you going to be there?
I will be there. It is on May 14th.
May 14th.
I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm doing something. I may be moderating. I'm not the panel. I'm not sure.
We shall meet again.
Yes,
I just got an invitation and I could not be more excited. I've never crossed that bridge, you know, that.
So you haven't seen
I've
Last
seen
House
it,
from
but
a
I've
distance.
Never. Yes. There's those for those of you that haven't seen it, there's these very foreboding signs that sort of say trespass at risk of own death, and I just never felt like I was that risky.
Yeah, and then there's the cattle guard you have to drive over.
Yep.
But nothing would happen to you.
Oh, well, you know, it's always better to go in with friends.
Yes, so April, May 14th, and I'll be writing about that event, which is open to the public. I'll be writing about that event in one of my columns so that people can get tickets.
Everyone should come.
Yeah,
it's very special. I mean, you know, it's quite, like I just said, it's quite the honor to be invited. And that place, Last House, is not a place that very many people have gotten to see.
No.
So.
No, and it's
encourage
I don't
people to come.
No, Last House isn't going to be open, is it?
No, but just going
you can walk
into,
by it.
You know, into
yes.
the this kind of special place that it's was an so amazing special estate. And inspiring
it's,
to her.
Yeah, yeah it's an amazing estate, and when she died, you know, her ashes were mm-hmm. scattered at the waterfall. There,
yes,
that,
and I almost just used the word sacred, and I wasn't sure if it was too lofty a word, but it's. I'm very excited to kind of get this view of this very.
Yeah, and you have to make sure you
place.
See the bell.
Okay, I'll make you show it to me.
Yeah, you have to see the bell because you know she had written about that bell, mm-hmm. and on the day of her memorial service, David Bouverie went out and rang the bell and came back. And there was a phantom ring.
Really?
Long after he was already back. It
wow.
had to be at least a full minute, maybe more than a minute. There was this other resounding peal. And I think half the people in the room cracked up.
Well, I mean, this may sound crazy, but I just believe that she is, you know, she's just present. You know, I think that she's present in food culture and present in, mm-hmm. in writing today. And
I agree.
I hope she would be happy with the book. So.
I think she would. I know that she would be. And I'll tell you, you know, Hillary Clinton might have talked out loud to Eleanor Roosevelt, but I often find myself talking to Mary Frances.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
The book, Anne Zimmerman and an Extravagant Hunger, The Passionate Years of M.F.K. Fisher from Counterpoint Press. It's really wonderful, and you can go to the website, writtenbyaz.com. It's a great title, and I wish you just mountains of success, and
thank
maybe you'll
you.
Come back to
yeah,
Mouthful
this
sometime.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. I'll definitely come back.
Okay, great, and you come back, too. Check us out next Sunday at 7 for another episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.
Mouthful is produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. It's engineered by Lawrence Alberti and Eric Black. For more information about Mouthful, email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also go to krcb.org and download podcasts of Mouthful as well as from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too, and he'll sing,
to the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. Time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says.
To the Lord,
let praise be.
Let it be.
It's time for dinner now, let's go.
We got some,
we got
beans.
Some beans and good cornbread.
Good cornbread.
Listen to what the preacher says.
To
the
Lord,
praises be.